Every storm has a break. Every night has a dawn. Easter is unstoppable, her grace inevitable. Every devil has his exorcism, and not every oppression is granted liberty through self-determination. I am a lucky man. I have a wife whom I love and loves me. I have a beautiful baby boy who will not remain a baby in my eyes forever. But until he's tall enough to stop accidentally headbutting me in the daddy bags, he remains my baby. He's such a curious nugget, so clever, and so ready. I was that once, but this isn't real to me. To my father, perhaps, but not to me. I am a passing thing, a placeholder of my family name. It is easy to forget. My son remains after I fade away into the mist. He can be my gift to the world, a better me, maybe, but for now, he is a nugget. If you let him, he can suck the evil right out of you, and he hasn't been here long enough to learn how to drink evil into himself. He's all feeling, reaction, and not much strategy. In my gym, I can watch him spin around a lolly column like it's a maypole and laugh him out. It may as well be nothing. I can sneak up on him and get him in the sleeper hold, and we can wrestle. Oh, it's a good balance. I worry sometimes that I'm too hard a man. I don't allow whining. I don't allow manipulation or churlish behavior. Others think that I may punish too soon. But how many sociopaths I've been creating by fostering weakness? I hug my son, remind him that I love him every day. I show more affection than men previous me and my family showed, who instead showed anger before all else. I punish from a place of calculation, and try, hard as I might, not to act in the heat of the moment and constrain my feelings. My earliest memories include being shouted down by larger, angrier men, and the world hasn't grown up all too much since then. I won't subject my son to that. And before we go down that road, no, it is not Chad behavior, it's being an asshole. There's a tremendous difference between controlled aggression and violent outbursts. Proof is in the pudding. It isn't delicious. I do not enjoy disciplining, but I enjoy the fruits of intemperance less. Well, consider, it is in a man's nature to dominate woman. It's in almost every holy book, as a law or warning, depending on whom you ask. This behavior is ingrained, hardwired. It begins as an evolutionary adaptation, along with everything else. A boy child will sniff out the weaker-willed parent, usually the woman, and play to her maternal weakness, which is an unfair word. Woman's maternity is an unconquerable strength when she owns it, but her resolve wanes. She undergoes complicated ego dramas far and away from a child's understanding. The woman caves, and the child learns he can get his way. If the father is stern or strict, the child learns divide et imperat. Does it surprise anyone that we live in a society of variable sociopaths? Every woman I have ever known has complained of between one and countless men manipulating her. Where does the behavior come from? What is the root? No need to throw out Occam's razor with the emo baby bathwater. Consequently, if the behavior is not nipped in the bud, it only magnifies. So think of this when you Google Gaga behavior that you would find appalling in a graybeard. Imagine a child, an old man, doing the same trick in his final form like it's a shitty episode of DBZ or something. The episode is now monstrous, or the behavior, rather, is now monstrous. Or imagine being guilted and wheedled by the one parent and shouted down by the other and harassed. It is a pattern being recognized. So, early and often, rebuke and correct. This is not a sin, and it may, forgive my dramatism, save your son much growing pain later. The woman of the house should have every ounce of moral authority of the father, and the son should have no more leniency with her than he. This doesn't mean that love dies. I love my son. Despite my role as part of Familia, Sai can be fun, we can laugh, and all that jive. We have inside jokes, but he knows that with me, when the laughter ends, the game is over. This is an important lesson. The world is not forgiving as good parents. Games and manipulation lead to dark paths out of context. Well, and I am vindicated. I shall continue to vindicate myself. My course is set, and by Walden we will overcome. His first memories will be of the games we played, the laughs we had, and I hope that the corrections fade into the ether. I already have my own memories, things that only a father can find funny, such as sitting after a long day of work, getting into the zone to do a sketch. I'm no stranger to being whacked by my son. I let him rough play with me. What kind of spleenless weenie would I be if I couldn't take it? Anyways, after a while, the whacking gets to stinging. I look down and saw I'm streaming with fresh, hot blood. Wee lad had found my wife's upholsterer's rotary cutter. I had a series of six or so gashes, and I laughed. How did I miss being stabbed by a midget? Was it really that long a day? The challenge is explaining that he can't roughhouse the women. They have no threshold for that kind of discomfort. Boys and girls don't play the same way. Chivalry begins early, too. Which means, if you can get away with stabbing Dad, you have beaten a larger, stronger, and for now smarter opponent, theoretically. But that rule does not apply to women. There will be no transgender basketball in my house. Boys go easy on girls, and they rough house with other boys. If the other boy can take it, and the environment is right. Which it isn't, not always. With so many other parents in my age, they are bubble-wrapping the children. So let me tell you something. Sometimes, when I can feel the demons of my lesser nature creep up, I remember the story of Thor and Thjalfi. I say Thor and Thjalfi pointedly. You will know the tale as part of a larger story, that of Thor's journey to the East, one of the better-known Eddic tales, and one of the most loved of Thor. I will tell you the tale in brief, and then I will dwell on the morals of the story for me. It happened once that Thor was traveling with companions on his way to Utgard. Why should he go there? To prove himself. Thor was a great foe of the Ettenkin, and regaled in combat against them. He had heard the king of Utgard offer to reward any god who would prove themselves in his court. Now, Thor had never lost against a giant, and he saw no reason to start, nor less shy away from a challenge. So, as he often did in those days, Thor asked Loki to accompany him. Given that Loki was closer to Enstok than he knew their ways and the paths to reach them. As opposites attract, Loki agreed. Thor was entertained by Loki's mischief, and Loki, though he might never admit it, respected Thor's straightforward simplicity. And so for this reason, they were often given to traveling with one another. The two gods bandied about for a spell, gathered their gear, and set it out. It is tough to tell how long it was they wandered before they grew tired. As they often did, the gods stopped at a home. Now here, on the border of Midgard, at the end of the world, in the shadow of the Iron Forest, stood the home. It was peopled with rustics, as homes often were, who knew little of the world. Thor smiled, and so did Loki. Thor smiled because the rustics were often honest folk, untainted by the pressures of urbane living. And as such, when they worked hard and rarely condescended, Loki smiled for much the same reason. Such folk hadn't learned pomp and pretense and lived exactly as they were, how they thought. The gods, long since disguised in travelers' garbs, were introduced themselves with borrowed names, unmemorable names with neither lineage nor weight, the kind of names the Hávamál warns us of, for one knows not which divine race the name belongs to. And the gods were ushered into the home and given pride of place, when pride for news the family had nothing to offer. So the hidden gods, covered in rough skins and worn hides, offered their tales. They gave no wondrous accounts of legend, they gave only the tales of the road. Time dragged on as it must, and when it came time for dinner, the family bustled about. Thor in his borrowed skins winced, and Loki cast a sidelong glance. Without words, they wondered how the peasants toiled so long and so hard and so little. They had neither bacon to hang, nor cabbage to raise. Root vegetables had been tossed into a bland stew lacking spice. Thor shook his head and looked at the family. "Go outside, fetch one of my goats." The man of the house looked to the lady of the home, and they looked back at Thor. "Oh, go," said Thor again, more loudly. Loki snickered as they went out. Thor followed. "Look here. This goat is very special to me. It is enchanted by a witch in the wood." He drew a sax from his robes and cut the goat's throat. allowing the peasants to draw pails to gather blood. If we save the skins and roll the bones up inside, come morning I can bring the goat back as it was. Thor narrowed his gaze, but no bone must be broken. All these terms were agreeable. Among the hungry, a cut of goat is no mean thing. The family dined on the goat. Loki himself, quite the prodigious eater, took note of the boy, a teenager who had put away more than his fair share. He elbowed the boy in the ribs and smiled. The boy looked back. Hey, kiddo, you want to know where they keep all the flavor, right? The kid shook his head. Loki picked up a bone. In the marrow, said the trickster. That's where. The boy looked away. Nope, he said. Loki grinned. Oh, come on. When are you going to get to eat like this again? The boy's will wavered. He looked to his sister, who shrugged. Meanwhile, Thor and the parents discussed some droll business or other, with Thor offering advice to the eager farmer and his wife. The boy, with a slick hand, snatched the bone from the platter and cracked it, sucking the marrow. His sister, no lean eater herself, nearly toppled along the table trying to grab it away. The boy relented and gave it to her, and she sank into the bliss at the flavor of the salt and the protein from the bone. The boy motioned to Loki, who declined. No, I couldn't, he chuckled. And so it went. The teenagers had forgotten their trepidations and went to bed with full bellies, as the parents and Thor lingered on late, discussing matters of the soil. It was later in the morning that the cock crew, as if the sage bird knew, when men did not, who quartered their kitchen. The sun had already risen, and the songbirds who gave them merry melodies. The god rose before his retinue, but not before his hosts. He nodded at them and smiled, saying nothing more. He walked outside, stretched and groaned to the sound of mighty sinews popping to life. He scratched at his beard and knelt down by the goatskins. Hey, kid, he muttered as he glanced over his shoulder to see if anybody was watching. Confident that his secrets would keep, he drew Mjolnir from around his neck, and without donning it, made a sign over the skins as he rolled them up, mumbling some words he had been taught long ago, not by a witch, but by his father. Slowly, the skins grew plump as they filled like sausage casings with blood and viscera. Soon the goats trembled to their feet, gently groaning themselves as their own sinews popped. Thor smiled, as he always did at times like these. He gathered his leads, meaning to tie the goats back to his chariot, disguised as a wagon. But he noticed one had a gruesome limp. The goat could never run again. Thor was beside himself and roared with such a force that there wasn't a songbird left when he lowered his voice to a dull, earth-shaking rumble. The mere force of his roar had sent the skins he was in to tatters, revealing his clean tunic and brutal form. The family knew that this was no mere wandering sorcerer, but a god, and there was only one god that carried a hammer. The parents fell to their knees and begged for mercy. Thor, whose hammer had flowed far above his head, lowered it gently. He sighed. Seeing the groveling mortals, he, so below his strength, closed his eyes a moment. Considering his goats, how they could run and prance, carry him to Utgard with ease and lightning speed. But now thunder and lightning would always be in a struggle to outpace each other, sound and light at variance. Now he would no longer be as swift when called upon. The boy came forward, after a short eternity of deliberation, and his trembling sister followed, despite the protestation against her. The boy confessed all, and begged the god to spare his family his wrath. Thor, now embarrassed, sat on a felled log. He noticed that Loki had temporarily absented himself, no doubt to take a very long piss. He struggled and chuckled and looked at the boy. "Do you have any idea what you've done?" he asked. The boy shook his head. "I would be well within my rights to call Weargild, child, and take your life," Thor sighed. "But a life calls for another. And no man can touch a god to harm him. And what kind of god would that make me?" Thor furrowed his brow. "But I will take your life," he said, smiling. "You and your sister will become my thralls." The parents, till now, breathing in hushed whispers, grew wide with trepidation. They would lose their children, but those children would also be afforded opportunities none else could grant. You see, adoption, or thraldom, to a god is an honor. Our modern mythology places superficial notions of civil rights above all things, but in the old caste, to be made a slave to a god meant divine welfare. When Thor adopted Thjalfi as his servant, he removed the boy from extreme poverty and probably early death. Indeed, Thjalfi gained ascendancy over men his superior by normal canon. In his stead, left alone, Thjalfi would have been a farmhand and maybe someday a bondsman if all went well. Thor's adoption of him made him a hero. See, Thor's anger was well known, but his mercies are seldom explored. Thor was the friend of the working man, and in a way, this is why. But he was also the god looked to by families, and it isn't hard to see why. Thor helps the worthy lift them up out of the mire in a way that others don't per se. Odin often looks to poets and heroes, but Thor is a god any father can love, for who hasn't, like Thor, in his gratitude and explicit direction, been abused by misunderstanding and youthful indulgence? The tale of Thor and Thjalfi is a moral tale. Thor, like a father, is well within his rights to punish and to withhold affection. Rather, he makes sure that those in his care knew what had gone wrong and holds no grudge. It is framed that he took children as slaves, but in truth he freed them. A father who is good will follow up correction with education, not a stream of empty, vitriolic lectures to void his emotional bowel, but constructive criticism with a moral lesson. Thor opens Thjalfi and his sister up to a wider world, shows them that their convictions pale in comparison to the deeper realities of living. Well, father doesn't want to deepen the child's reality, increase the yield of the opportunities. It is tempting to act out of anger and to forget the picture, to, in the confrontation with the tantrum, devolve yourself into something undisciplined. But the mark of a good father is to stay the course. So, anyway, there's all that then. I hope you kids are all having a good week out there.